From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. Health workers in Papua New Guinea are calling for a dramatic change as hospital shelves run bare. Several hospitals are completely out of drug and testing kits. Others are scrounging for stocks of life-saving drugs like antivirals. Some remote health centers have closed altogether. Jamie Tahana reports.
At Port Moresby General Hospital, the gynecology department's been out of drugs for weeks. The head of department, Glenn Moller, says they're running low on most things: painkillers, bandages, and recently, syphilis testing kits.
Syphilis testing is really important because 4% of our pregnant ladies are found to have syphilis in their blood by testing. So that's about 100 a month. We deliver nearly 1,500 babies a month. But the important thing is you have to test everybody. You can't predict who the four out of the 100 will be.
Professor Moller says a bulk supply of kits is supposed to come about twice a year. The latest one is 2 months overdue. He says babies have probably died because of the shortage.
We have more stillbirths, so we just don't know because we can't test. So, you know, you get to the audit meeting at the end of every month to see why babies die, and then there's some big babies that didn't make it, and you just have to wonder, could it be syphilis? We can't test. So you're just left thinking, oh, goodness gracious, perhaps we could have saved this baby's life. We don't really know.
It's not just testing kits. Last month, the country ran critically low on antiretrovirals. The drugs used to control HIV in the country with the highest prevalence of HIV/AIDS in Asia. When the order didn't come, Professor Moller's hospital ate into its buffer supply. Then, doctors went around other clinics in the city, trying to scrounge together some stock. He says the drugs are critical, and if treatment is interrupted, a drug-resistant form of HIV can develop.
In other countries, New Zealand, for example, if you were found to have resistant virus because you'd interrupted your treatment, then you would be put on second-line or third-line antiretrovirals, which are about 100 times the price. We can't afford these. So if people interrupt their treatment and then their bodies get taken over by resistant virus, it's just bad luck now. You're going to die from AIDS.
When the antiretroviral shortage hit the headlines last month, the government finally ordered an emergency supply. But that got stuck on the wharf for a week because, as the health minister told Parliament, the woman at customs who could sign the drugs into the country was missing. Professor Moller's situation is not unique. 40% of the country's remote aid clinics have closed because of shortages, while others don't have supplies of power or water. The head of the PNG Institute of National Affairs, Paul Barker, says there's been no consistent health funding for years, and crippling shortages have become too common.
Every so often there's a report, oh look, it's just been fixed, we've got something in. But of course then a week or so later we seem to be sort of without again. You can't just provide it 1 week and then have a big gap. It's absolutely crucial that you have regular provision.
Dr. Barker says the crisis is part of a wider cash flow crisis that's seen teachers go unpaid and public servants locked out of offices because departments haven't been paying rent. A few years ago, anticipating great riches from a liquefied natural gas project, the government brought in free healthcare and banned clinics from charging patients. But Dr. Barker says the oil money never came.
We introduced the tuition-free education and the free health service providers. We're then being told you can't collect these funds, and therefore the money that was being available for the government and church health services was actually having to be stretched further because that supplementary revenue wasn't able to be gained.
The Health Minister, Sir Pukatemu, is yet to respond to requests for comment, but insists the government is working hard to solve the shortages and has actually increased the health budget. But obstetrician Mary Rose Bagita, who says she's recently had to work with no running water, says the money's not reaching the hospitals.
So even though we're told that there's some money available and needs to help the health system, unfortunately those at the health facility levels, and we don't seem to see the effects of that money.
But Professor Moller says part of the problem is priorities. When the government was confident of oil riches, it went on a spending spree in Port Moresby. Flyovers and new stadiums popped up, and for 2 days this year, PNG will host the glitzy APEC Summit, for which there will be a new multi-million dollar conference centre.
A lot of money is being put into APIC. Yeah, hundreds and hundreds, perhaps a billion or something, I think, has been spent on infrastructure for APIC. 2 days, the meetings for 2 days. I mean, I'm not an expert in this area, but it just doesn't seem logical to me. Meanwhile, there's no money for health.
Everyone in a sector on its knees says there needs to be urgent and substantial reform, from the way drugs are procured to the bureaucracy that gets them in to how staff are paid. Paul Barker says that push for substantial reform is even coming from overseas. But so far, as PNG goes through its latest crisis, there seems little prospect for change. This is Jamie Tahana.
An obstetrician in Papua New Guinea says complex societal issues such as poor family planning, limited infrastructure, a financial-starved health system, and domestic violence are behind the rise in maternal deaths. A recent report by the Child Fund Australia has found that one in 120 women are dying during pregnancy and childbirth, and they are 30 times more likely to die in labor than Australian mothers, with the situation becoming worse over the past 5 years. Jenny Meyer asked Dr. Mary Rose Bagata why more women are losing their lives.
That's a really big question, because we really need a lot of things improved and changed in order to improve our maternal mortality rate. We know that we could significantly improve our maternal mortality rates if we could address family planning and also improve our basic emergency care at the time of birth and delivery. We've tried over the years to try and push for family planning for families to reduce the number of children they have, but it's not going the way that we would like it to go. The uptake of family planning is not satisfactory yet. And with regard emergency training for our health workers who do the deliveries, we've also had a lot of effort put in by our partners to train especially our lower level health workers to upskill them in their skills in emergency obstetric care and all that. So we're hoping that whatever skills they've learned, they've taken back to the village and district level, so that will improve things as well.
It sounds like it really is very tough for women living in the rural areas.
It's really tough, yeah. Yes. Because not only dealing with this, but actually had gaining access to the health facilities themselves. It's quite difficult because you know that most of our people live in the rural areas, and infrastructure in the rural places is not that good. So most of our places are accessible by air only, and the road condition in provinces that have roads available is quite poor.
You're working there in Port Moresby. You must see the most unwell pregnant women, I imagine. Sometimes is it too late to help them and their babies?
Yeah, that's right. Most times it's too late to help the women and the babies. Because we're based in Port Moresby, but we also receive referrals from the surrounding provinces. It's access mainly. So by the time the women are referred and they reach us, it's usually too late. So we try our best to do the best we can to save mother and baby, but in most instances, it's too late.
It's very sad, isn't it? And why do you think it's just got so much worse in the last 5 years, despite there being so much investment in trying to train people up, trying to get these more dispersed health clinics up and running, and really they're just, some of them have got no running water or proper toilet facilities, so they become a liability too. Why has it got worse in the last 5 years?
One of the reasons is our health system and financing the health system. We actually rely a lot on our donor partners and development partners to help fund our health delivery system. And although the government has put in a lot of money into the healthcare system, we don't really seem to see where it's going. Then there's those issues of procuring drugs and trying to get them to the places where they're supposed to go. It's really a complex issue. So even though we're told that there's money available and it's a lot of government money available to help the health system. Unfortunately, those at the health facility levels and even us in Port Moresby, we don't seem to see the effects of that money. So, yeah, it's all very complex.
And just finally, what role does violence and domestic violence towards pregnant women come into all of this? You know, it sounds like we know that violence is a problem in Papua New Guinea anyway, and we know that there are problems with healthcare and the provision of maternity care. But when those two things combine, it just must be terrible for the families involved.
Yeah, that's right. We do have high levels of domestic violence. So because a lot of our societies, patrilineal societies, so the husband is more dominant. And then a lot of our women who are from the rural areas, they're not that well educated. So they depend a lot on the husband for their socioeconomic status. So coming from a culture where there's male dominance, and if the woman is not well educated, she can't speak up for herself. She doesn't have much control over what she can do. So that adds on problems to pregnant women, because if their husbands are not able to help care for them in the pregnancy, and then on top of that, yeah, there's domestic violence in the family, then it obviously has poor outcome for the mother, because their health-seeking behavior it's hindered, I'd say. They feel like they don't have anywhere else to go because the person who's supposed to be looking after them is not really looking after them.
Mm. And it must be also poor outcomes for the child and the children.
That's right. Poor outcomes for babies and children as well.
It sounds like a very distressing kind of field to be keeping on going every day when there's so much more that needs to be done. But it does sound like those people who are working in those rural areas, they need all the support they can get. Would you say that?
That's really true. We need to support our rural health workers and our rural population much more than what we're doing at the moment.
Samoa's School of Nursing has launched a postgraduate program to boost the number of nurses with higher qualifications. The National University of Samoa and Wellington's Victoria University are participating to provide the program, which they hope will allow students to keep working in their own communities, support their families, and contribute to the development of nursing in Samoa. The Dean of the Facility of Health at Victoria University, Professor Greg Koska, told Sarah Vietalitu, it is an exciting time to help develop Samoa's health research and staff.
Well, the primary focus of the program is to develop the capability of the Faculty of Health at NUS to offer postgraduate courses for nurses, midwives, and potentially other health professionals with the intention of contributing to the health system in Samoa through research and health practice development. It's a program and developed to take place over 6 years, and we'll train 6 PhDs, 10 masters, and deliver 40 courses all in-country, fees paid, and taught jointly between the Faculty of Health staff here and the staff up in Samoa.
Oh, so is it like a mix of online and in-person teaching, or how does it work?
Yes, it's a mix. We'll have our staff go up to NUS and mentor and teach, but there'll also be online supervision as well as supervision directly in country. So really it's a way of delivering postgraduate education particularly for the academic staff at NUS and the School of Nursing, so that they can stay in country. They don't have the costs of coming down to New Zealand. And I think that way they can contribute to teach, continue to learn, and gain their qualification at the same time.
Has it taken some time to organise?
Yes, it has actually. We started this in 2015, and as a result of conversations between the School of Nursing staff at NUS and the Graduate School of Nursing Midwifery and Health staff at Victoria. So it has taken some time to get it across the line. But we're very pleased that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade in New Zealand has contributed on behalf of the government $1.75 million New Zealand dollars to this program over a period of 5 years. So this isn't a government-to-government relationship, but I think that's a demonstration of the New Zealand government's and Victoria University's commitment to the Pacific.
And what was the reaction at the launch by some of the locals?
Oh, I think huge excitement. We were very, very pleased to have the Prime Minister of Samoa do the launch, and he and I both spoke. It was a wonderful occasion, and people are very excited. I do want to acknowledge Dame Winnie Laban, made a dame over the weekend. As you know, she is Associate Professor Honourable Luamanuva'u, Dame Winnie Laban, and she's the Assistant Vice-Chancellor Pacifica at the university. She's made a huge contribution in getting this going, and it's her connections in the Pacific really that have allowed us to successfully get this agreement in place.
And so what does it mean for the future nursing staff in Samoa?
What's good about this and what's important about it is that it develops academic nursing staff in Samoa and gets them PhDs or master's degrees. That then allows them to run PhD programs themselves up in Samoa. So the degrees that they'll get will be a Victoria University of Wellington PhD or master's, but they can then start delivering their own PhD program in country. So it's a development opportunity, and it then means that young students going into nursery and midwifery education and leadership in Samoa can see that there are pathways forwards for research, for education. There's one other thing that's really very valuable about this program is that when we were talking to the Ministry of Health and indeed the Minister of Health and the Minister of Education in Samoa, they made the point that they really need some specialty nursing staff, people who can work in cardiology or neurology or mental health or infectious diseases or non-communicable diseases. And the master's program will offer courses that will help develop some specialist skills for nurses in Samoa that they can take practice roles in the Samoan health system.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A New Zealand university is hoping to boost its number of Pacific students and academics through a range of initiatives. Pacifica people rank low on the list of those in New Zealand with university qualifications. That's according to the Ministry of Education, although the number is steadily rising. 7% of Waikato University student population is Pacifica, and it's trying to capitalize on these growing numbers. The university's Deputy Vice Chancellor, academic Robin Lunghurst, told Jamie Tahana they brought in a plan to try to attract more Pacifica students, but also to keep them studying.
We want the students not just to come, but come and be well supported. You know, they need to come and succeed. So what we're really paying attention to is making sure that once students get with us, we're able to support them. So the last thing we want is for them to arrive with us and then, you know, not succeed, not complete their first year, not go through on to completing second and third year and graduating. So yes, we certainly do want more Pacific students coming to study with us, but we also want to make sure that once they get here, we're able to do a really great job with them in ensuring their success.
What's this Pacific learning or support you talk about in the plan? Because you identify a unique way of doing it, I guess. Mm-hmm. What is this and how are you going to go about doing it?
We have support across the university at the broader level for our Pacific students. So that means both social support for them, like pastoral care, but also it means learning support and development. But we also have that support offered within particular faculties so that it's disciplinary based. So law is a good example for us. We have a number of Pacific students studying law and they have their own support systems within the faculty of law as well. So we find that that operates well on multiple scales. By sort of disciplinary support but broader support across the institution. We like to put in place specific pedagogy so that we incorporate those into students' learning, and that's partly about an approach towards collectivity and not just treating students as individuals but as part of broader groups and whānau and social structures, involving friends and family, and that's been part of the rationale behind us opening a new Pacific Centre that we call the CONT.
You're talking about making the transition to university easier for Pacifica. I mean,
yeah.
we know it is lower than, say, the Pākehā populations in New Zealand, albeit growing. What's needed here, and what is it that the universities themselves can do?
I think making sure that students feel very supported by a community of learners once they arrive here, so that they're not left high and dry by themselves struggling. They've got a cohort. We find that that's really successful for us. If students are part of a cohort of learners, then they're far more likely to be successful. Other things that we're putting in place are things like, and at first year level, a very early piece of assessment. It might only be quite minor, but maybe just 3 weeks into a course, having a small piece of work that's due, so that we can see very early on how students are doing. And if they're not doing well, we're able to move in very quickly and offer them the assistance that they need, whether that might be pastoral care, it might be learning development, but those sort of early triggers to make sure that, again, that we help students to succeed. So there's all sorts of things like that, I think, that universities can and are and need to be putting into place. And we're talking here about Pacific students, but of course it's for a range of students. It's Māori students, it's first and family students, it's students who might have a disability of some sort. So for all our learners, these are really good strategies.
The World Bank wants to see more women involved in Australia's seasonal work program. A new bank report called The Social Impacts of Seasonal Migration, Lessons from Australia's Seasonal Worker Program, has laid out how to solve some of the social impacts of the scheme that has delivered financial benefits to many people in island countries and provided valuable resource for Australian horticulture. A small percentage of the seasonal workers since the start of the program 8 years ago have been women. But a special protection economist at the World Bank, Jesse Doyle, told Don Wiseman they want to lift in these numbers to ensure women get the same opportunities as men.
The World Bank's done a lot of work on the seasonal worker program over the last 10 years, including labour productivity assessments and impact assessments, looking at the development impacts of the scheme in sending countries. And this was sort of a piece that came out of that earlier research. And what we really wanted to look at was two things. One was the social impacts of the program for sending families. And the second was the role that women could play in the program. And it's been a big challenge to increase participation of women in the seasonal worker program. It has been increasing over the past years, in absolute terms, but the percentage of women out of the total number that are going to Australia in any given year has remained roughly the same. Obviously, there are huge benefits to bringing women into the program and giving them work in Australia. And so the question is sort of how we can go about doing that.
So what are those percentages at the moment?
So the latest data that we have is sort of around the 14 to 15% mark. And so, as I mentioned before, the number has increased year on year, but as a percentage of total arrivals in Australia, it's remained roughly the same, around 14% since the inception of the seasonal worker program in 2012.
And what would the specific benefits be of having more women involved?
The benefits are innumerable, but many of the benefits are similar to those that men currently enjoy in participating in the program. So one is the chance for gainful employment and a much higher wage than is possible in many of the sending countries. And with that comes the ability to send remittances home to one's family and also build a livelihood with that money that's been earned in Australia.
And what sort of reception has this thinking had in the island countries?
Look, I think there's a lot of receptiveness to increasing women's participation in the program in sending countries. I think some of the constraint comes from the perceptions of employers in Australia. Obviously, the program is concentrated in the agriculture sector. And unfortunately, the large share of employment in agriculture in Australia is still dominated by men. So there's a question of sort of how you can break that barrier. And I think it's both about changing perceptions in sending communities. So how we can change perceptions around women's role in the workplace in sending communities, but also for approved employers in Australia who otherwise have previously been hiring predominantly men.
Can I look at other aspects of the scheme? I don't know whether the work you've done covers them, but for some time now there's been desire within the Pacific to expand it beyond this simple low skills work involved in the horticulture field, broadening it. And is that likely to happen soon?
Yes, so the seasonal worker program during the pilot phase from 2008 to 2012 did actually try out a number of sectors, including accommodation, tourism, aquaculture. And now currently in the program, it is possible for workers under the seasonal worker program to access jobs in tourism and accommodation. But beyond this program, which is just focusing on short-term work for 6 months in Australia, the Australian government is rolling out a new program as of July this year, which is called the Pacific Labour Scheme. And the specific objective of that program will be to bring workers across in semi-skilled type occupations. And that extends from sort of health services to accommodation and a number of other sectors. So I think the Pacific Island governments are really looking at this new scheme as an opportunity to move up the skills ladder and start sending workers in higher skilled roles.
And that's something that the World Bank would be, well, you would approve of.
Absolutely. I think the seasonal worker program is certainly an important part of the policy mix. And obviously, since the beginning of the program in 2012, there's been over 17,000 workers sent from the Pacific to Australia, and that's brought back about $144 million in net income gains to the region. So that's hugely beneficial. But I think for both the Australian government and the Pacific governments, they're looking at ways that Pacific workers can be brought across in high-skilled sectors, and the World Bank is certainly keen to support that effort. One project that we're working with is in Tonga, and that includes investments in technical and vocational education and training, and also sort of pre-departure training and other measures to facilitate access to higher skill jobs in Australia. And that's sort of been seen as a bit of a pilot project for the region that, if successful, could be replicated across other countries.
When you quote figures about the amount of money going back, are we talking about the potential in terms of that's what's earned, or is that the money that is actually finding its way back to the island countries?
So that's from an impact evaluation that we've been undertaking over the past 2 years and actually launched in March. What we did was basically collected a whole bunch of data on the amount that workers are earning in Australia and the amount that they're remitting back to their home countries. And that's just an aggregate figure basically across the entire program. So looking at the total number of workers that have worked in Australia and the average amount that they're sending by country.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's pcjmedia@gmail.com, pcjmedia@gmail.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.